Hi, Dave Emery here. This is For the Record, program number 1349, Conversations with Monty. This is conversation number 23, and this is being recorded on October 5th of the year 2024. And before we get into the subject material, and we're going to be resuming our analysis of things Asian, and we're going to show people the extent to which everything they're hearing about China, about the Indo-Pacific, blah, 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 blah. We are literally just picking up where the Japanese left off at the end of World War II, really before, and the Korean and Vietnam Wars were part of that. But this will be a long series. I want to remind people, though, that the latest flash drive, and this one will be 64 gigabytes, is, it will be available later this year, and people can start queuing up for that. It will have all of the conversations with Monty, probably through, maybe October, November, whatever, plus all of the work that I did on the origins of COVID. And I get no money whatsoever from this. Monty gets no money whatsoever from this. Proof positive, I think, that my worst critics may be absolutely correct in that this is my whole life's work, and I'm getting no money from that, and they may be correct about nuts. But anyway, again, the new 64-gigabyte flash drive, it is in the process of aborting, as they say. So people that want to archive this material, and I would recommend emphatically that they do, because I don't think that we as a species or us as a civilization are going to make it. I think this is the twilight, if not the twilight of the gods, the twilight of the humans. Anyway, that is by way of introduction. And by way also of introduction, I want to bring back, it is my pleasure and privilege to bring back to our airwaves, Monty. Monty, welcome back.
Thank you, Dave.
And I'm going to, in order to resume the thread of what we've been talking about, I'm going to reread some sections. And people may be thinking, why are these guys talking about Asia? You know, golly gee, you know what? I mean, what about Japan? What? Jack Ruby's last letter out of prison on January 31st, 1966. And I'm reading now from the book The Man Who Knew Too Much by Dick Russell, hardcover edition, Carolyn Graff, copyright 1992. And Ruby wrote, and again, this is January 31st, 1966. Don't believe the Warren Report. That was only put out to make me look innocent. I'm going to die a horrible death anyway, so what would I have to gain by writing all this? So you must believe me. There was only one kind of people that would do such a thing. That would have to be the Nazis. And that is who is in power in this country right now. Japan is also in on the deal, but the old warlords are going to come back. South America is also full of these Nazis. If those people were so determined to frame me, then you must be convinced that they had an ulterior motive for doing the same. There was only one kind of people that would go to such extremes, and that would be the master race. One of the things we noted, Monty, that even given the wonderful and exhaustive efforts of so many JFK researchers, for whatever reason, they steer clear of the Nazi connections, which are profound and inextricably linked with what's going on. But for our purposes here, note that Jack Ruby, on January 31st, 1966, said, Japan is also in on the deal, and the old warlords are going to come back. Well, they really never left. And in witness to that, from the book JFK, the CIA of Vietnam and the Plot to Assassinate John F. Kennedy by Colonel L. Fletcher, Prouty, hardcover edition, Skyhorse Publisher. Prouty was in Okinawa as Okinawa was being filled with munitions staged for the invasion of Japan. Then once the atomic bombs were dropped on Hiroshima and Nagasaki, that became academic. And Prouty was on the beach in the harbor, and he wrote as follows. I was on Okinawa at that time and doing some business in the harbor area. I asked the harbor master if all that new material was being returned to the States. His response was direct and surprising. Hell no. They ain't never gonna see it again. One half of this stuff, enough to equip and supply at least 150,000 men, is going to Korea. And the other half is going to Indochina, unquote. And Knight probably writes, in 1945, none of us had any idea that the first battles of the Cold War were going to be fought by U.S. military units in those two regions beginning in 1950 and 1965. Yet that is precisely what had been planned, and it is precisely what happened. Who made that decision back in 1943 to 1945? And then also, to give you some more continuity, from the book, The Nightmare Decade, The Life and Times of Senator Joe McCarthy by Fred J. Cook, copyright 1971, published in hardcover by Random House, Cook writes, when the war ended, China was in utter chaos. Thousands of Japanese troops wandered around the countryside fully armed with no one accepting their surrender. John F. Melby, capital M-E-L-B-Y, a State Department officer, in a day-by-day diary he kept at the time, reflected in bewilderment upon this anomaly. On December 27, 1945, he noted, quote, I still don't understand about the Japanese. Officially, they are being disarmed. But the fact is, they never seem to be. In Shanghai, 15,000 still walk the streets with full equipment. In Nanking, which, by the way, was the seat of the Kuomintang government of Chiang Kai-shek, in Nanking, the high Japanese generals are bosom buddies of the Chinese. In the north, tens of thousands of Japanese soldiers are used to guard railroads and warehouses and to fight the communists. If you ask what this is all about, the answer is either a denial or, in more candid moments, a shh, we don't talk about that, unquote. In another entry on January 30th, 1947, a good 16 months after VJ Day, Melby noted that, though it was being kept, quote, very quiet, unquote, there were, again quoting, 80,000 holdout Japanese troops, that's his word, I would say there weren't holdouts, but 80,000 holdout Japanese troops in eastern and northwestern Manchuria who are fully equipped fighting the communists. And yet another very telling passage, and this comes from one of the most important books ever written, and I would say that if people wish to understand Asia, or really to understand the world as it exists today, including the international financial system, they need to come to terms with this book. It appears to have cost the authors their lives, the writing of it. Gold Warriors by Sperling and Peggy Seagrave, published in hardcover, softcover by Verso. And they write, in October of 1949, the People's Republic of China came into being. 8 months later, in June of 1950, the Korean War broke out. Just before the war began, Kodama Yoshio accompanied John Foster Dulles to negotiations in Seoul, South Korea. The Dulles party also included Kodama's protege Machii Hayasuki, that's capital M-A-C-H-I-I, last name capital H-I-S-A-Y-U-K-I, boss of the Korean Yakuza in Japan. Efforts to discover under freedom of information what Kodama and Machii did during the trip with Dulles have run into a stone wall. In the MacArthur Memorial Archive, we discovered a personal letter from Kodama to General MacArthur offering to provide thousands of Yakuza and former Japanese Army soldiers to fight alongside the American soldiers in Korea. According to sources in Korea and Japan, the offer was accepted, and these men joined the Allied force on the peninsula, posing as Korean soldiers. And I'm also going to read some points of inquiry, and this is going to take a long time to talk about. And Monty, fool that I am, when we were speaking on the phone, you mentioned some research you'd come across with a fellow, on a fellow named Tsuji Masanobu, and we'll talk about him. It's just fascinating, and I think in many ways it illustrates the dynamic in Asia. But some of the points that we are going to be talking about in this series. When Jack Ruby was posing as a reporter at a press conference on the evening of November 22nd, 1963, it might have been past midnight, so that might have been technically November 23rd, but he was posing as a reporter, and when a Dallas law enforcement official spoke about Lee Harvey Oswald being a member of the Free Cuba Committee, which was an anti-Castro group, Ruby broke in and said, no, the Fair Play for Cuba Committee, which was a pro-Castro group. Oswald was its only New Orleans member. The head of the group discouraged Oswald from forming the chapter. But standing right next to Ruby at that conference was a member of the Cabinet Research Bureau, which was an ultra-Japanese intelligence organization. And that may be one of the reasons why Ruby was able to write as he did on January 31st of 1966. And again,
Right. There appears to be an officer of the Ministry of Foreign Affairs for the Cabinet Research Bureau standing right next to Jack Ruby as he was more or less setting up Mr. Oswald, painting him red, one of the last little brush strokes, making him look like a communist agitator, which he was in fact in all likelihood, politically, the extreme opposite. But yes, that man has been identified as Sassa, Mr. Sassa. Last name spelling on that is Sassa. His first name is Atsuyuki, and the spelling on that is Atsuyuki, Atsuyuki Sasa. And what's fascinating about Mr. Sasa's presence there is that the timetables of it don't match up, because the official Warren Report testimony on Mr. Sasa is that he doesn't show up until roughly 10 days after the assassination of President Kennedy. But clearly there is a photograph and film footage of him inside of the Dallas courthouse standing right next to Jack Ruby. Once again, I know I've said this before in a previous program, but the Cabinet Research Bureau, if you were to encapsulate what it represented in 1963, try to imagine, and this is specifically for listeners here in the United States, try to imagine the Federal Bureau of Investigation, the CIA, and Army Intelligence all lugged into one super organization. That was the Japanese Cabinet Research Bureau as it was active in 1963. So that ought to give you some idea of the responsibility that this character, Mr. Sasa, had. And certainly his record is fascinating, because he would later go on in the 1980s, I believe it was 1985, all the way up until around 1989. He was the chief of security and the personal bodyguard for the emperor. So
Wow, and
that ought to just give you some idea of how Mr. Sasa's career skyrocketed in the ensuing decades.
I think if memory serves me correctly, Hiroshito, it's spelled Hirohito, Hiroito, pronounced Hiroshito. He died, I think, in 1989, so he would have been the bodyguard for Emperor Hiroshito. One of the things you noted, Monty, is that my decades of research have been Eurocentric, and that's quite true. And to make a very, very, very long story that we would be unpacking for you, very, very, very short, the same thing was going on in Asia that was going on in Europe. And just as General Reinhard Gehlen and his organization, which was described by former Marine Colonel William Corson as, quote, a front for Odessa Nazis, meaning SS.
Right.
General Seizu Arisu, who might be termed the Japanese Gehlen, was doing the same thing in Asia. And so was another notorious Japanese officer. And I guess this is proof maybe that my critics again are absolutely correct that I'm nuts. But you mentioned something to me, and I think, in the partial defense of myself, What I'm going to ask you to unpack for us before I read the rest of these bullet points, in many ways illustrates the dynamic we're talking about. But this guy's name is Tsuji, capital P-S-U-J-I, Masanobu, capital M-A-S-A-N-O-B-U.
Right, right.
And
yeah,
he's
Colonel
linked,
Masanobu.
Not only linked to General Arisu, but he was one of the principals in charge of the Bataan Death March. And his behavior, he also went to work for the U.S. And I think that, you know, the late Iris Chang, who was writing not only a book, but doing a documentary film about the Bataan Death March, her alleged suicide, the 20th anniversary of which is coming up next month, was no suicide at all. She was murdered. When I spoke with the late Sperling Seagrave,
right,
in 2009, preparatory to the interview that is contained in, for the record, 689, I mentioned Iris Chang, and he was convinced that she was murdered. He would not talk about it on the air, and Sperling Seagrave is no shrinking violet, so that's an indication. But Tsuji Masanobu was notorious with regard to the Bataan Death March, and if you would encapsulate, I know that's asking a lot, Monty, but what Masanobu was doing vis-a-vis the Bataan Death March, undoubtedly some of that witnessed by some of the survivors that Iris was doing, and also what you mentioned to me last night about his work for the U.S. as a liaison with Chiang Kai-shek of the Kuomintang, whom in theory, and boy is it theoretical, was supposed to have been fighting the Japanese in World War II. Go ahead, Tsuji Masanobu, the Bataan Death March, Masanobu's dietary habits, and the element, the element that you mentioned last night about what he was doing for the U.S. when he was also working for General Arisu, the Japanese Galen.
Right. Well, if I were to real quick just encapsulate what his responsibilities were throughout the entirety of the Second World War, and unfortunately I don't have the materials in front of me. I believe that Masanobu was actually charged by General Yamashita, Tomoyuki Yamashita, to be in charge initially of the rear guard actions for the Kwantung Army and Japanese occupied Mongolia. Okay, so in a sense, tactically speaking, Masanobu's job throughout the entirety of the Second World War was to run a rear guard action organization for the occupation of Malaysia. You know, so that was his primary job. And it's exactly what it sounds like. You know, Masanobu's job was, in fact, to run security battalions that would act as terrorist teams, you know, cellularized terrorist teams to wage nonstop economic and, of course, direct military warfare against the peoples of Malaysia. You know, and, you know, before we jump forward to what he's doing for the CIA, after the Second World War, and yes, I do have proof that he was a structural CIA agent, it should be appreciated that the chief of OSS operations in Malaysia during the Second World War was a man by the name of Richard Greenlee, who later became a task force commander and an economic warfare officer for Theodore Shackley at a CIA base called JM Wave. Yeah, for the anti-caste effort. So, you know, just bear that in mind that that's his counterpart in Malaysia during the Second World War.
And when we unpack these elements, we need to be very careful to document these as well, because I know you have the documentation, but there are listeners who will be wondering, where does that come from? Go ahead.
Oh, well, the documentation for Richard Greenlee, real quick, comes from, That would come from, let's see if I could pull up the...
It's not important. Not important right now. We'll pick it up later. But what I'm wondering about is Masanobu.
That documentation, real quick, that's easy enough. That comes from the United States Army Special Operations Command, History Office, that talks about the history of Task Force 404, which was the OSS cadre in Malaysia. But skipping forward, to his, how exactly he falls into military intelligence. In 1942, as you pointed out, Masanobu, ends up as, the plans officer for the last major attacks into Guadalcanal. So ultimately he's a liaison officer directly to the chief occupied military intelligence commander in that theater of operations. And of course, you know, that would include collaborators with Chiang Kai-shek's government. And this can be found in recently declassified CIA files on Masanobu, that he was in fact conducting this liaison activity all from at least 1942 to the end of the war, and it appears that it's been picked up by the CIA. So,
am I remembering correctly that it was Masanobu's 201 file with the CIA that mentioned that Masanobu, post-World War II, was the primary liaison officer between the CIA, or the fledgling CIA, and Chiang Kai-shek and the Kuomintang, which on the one hand would seem, you know, bizarre perhaps, and yet bearing in mind what we looked at in the long series. Go ahead.
Once again, it has to be appreciated, as I just stated, throughout the Second World War, from 1942 to the end of the war, he's running the intelligence activities in Malaysia. And politically, it would, like you, as you just pointed out, that may seem odd, maintaining a relationship with Chiang Kai-shek, even though he was working with American forces at this time, primarily the American volunteer groups under Claire Chennault. But it has to be appreciated that Chiang Kai-shek was a gangster, an opportunistic gangster who would be willing to work with anybody in order to keep him in power, you know? So, you know, the nationalist elements Kuomintang and the Kuomintang armies, you know, these border armies that were working with the Kuomintang, it has to be appreciated that these units were essentially gangster organizations that Masanobu was working with. Yeah, I mean, I know that's in all likelihood an unfair assessment of the individual Chinese nationalist combat soldier, but that's the way Chiang Kai-shek played it. You know?
Oh, absolutely. And there was a long series that I did, based largely, though not exclusively, on Sterling Seagrave's book, The Song Dynasty, for the record 1195 through, for the record, 1214. And basically, Chiang Kai-shek's Kuomintang was a front for the drug-dealing Green Gang of Shanghai, led by Big-Eared Two, Tuyu Aching. And the Green Gang had gotten effective control over the Wampo Military Academy in China. That was basically China's equivalent of West Point. And all of the top officers in the Kuomintang Army, in the Nationalist Chinese Army, were also simultaneously gangsters for the Green Gang. So the Chiang Kai-shek's Kuomintang was literally a front for the drug dealing Green Gang, and the links between the Kuomintang and its drug dealing activities and the, by the end of World War II, more profound drug dealing activities of the fascist Japanese could not be exaggerated. And the most powerful man in, quote, nationalist, unquote, China was not Chiang Kai-shek, but it was the aforementioned Tuyu Aching. And he made it very clear to Chiang Kai-shek that, hey, you're the front man, but I'm the boss, and that's all there is to it. Before we move on from General Tsuji Masanobu, and I just the alleged suicide of Iris Chang, Tsuji Masanobu's dietary habits and how that related to, among other things, to the Bataan Death March.
Well, it's unpleasant to talk about, even though we have talked about it in previous programs. Masanobu was identified by at least a dozen and a half, shall I say, survivors, veterans of the Bataan Death March. that saw him engaging in ritualistic cannibalism against the POWs involved in that forced march. So,
and one wonders if some of them had related that to Iris Chang, and if that was among the factors leading to her murder. And I'm convinced she was murdered. Among the other bullet points, and that really is an ironic thing, among the other points of inquiry, and we will be going into these at greater length, much greater length, as this series unfolds. Both Syngman Rhee, who was the fascist dictator of what became South Korea, and that is not an exaggeration, as late as 1980, Syngman Rhee's forces, or the force, I think he was gone by that point, but the fascist dictatorship in what is now South Korea massacred a great many people. I've forgotten how many, and the town of which it took place in 1980, but both Syngman Rhee, the fascist dictator of what became South Korea, and Ngo Dzin-Jien, the head of what was once South Vietnam, both worked for the Japanese and during the Japanese occupation of Asia. We also hear a lot about the Uyghurs. You know, the Uyghurs are being persecuted by the Chinese. And by the way, representatives of many Muslim countries have traveled to China, and they absolutely have thrown cold water on the notion that the Chinese are persecuting the Uyghurs. And interesting enough, that information comes from Adrian Zins, who is a fellow with the Victims of the Communism Memorial Foundation itself, an offshoot of the Captive Nations Committee, which is an offshoot of the OUND, co-founded by Lev Dobryansky and, drumroll fanfare, Yaroslav Stetsko, the head of the World War II Nazi collaborationist government in Ukraine. But the Uyghurs were used by the Japanese as well as the Kuomintang as combatants against the Allies, and we'll be talking about that at greater length. Something that, as a member of the Vietnam generation, Monty, something that resonates particularly strongly with me, the dividing of Korea, by the way, Ku Kim, who is regarded as a Korean patriot and was against the division of Korea, as were many others. But Korea was divided at the 38th parallel by David Dean Rusk and Colonel Bonesteel. David Dean Rusk does not usually use the name David. He became JFK's Secretary of State and remained beautifully silent when JFK was killed, in part because of his Vietnam policy. And Dean Rusk served LBJ right to the end of his term as Secretary of State. And Colonel Bonesteel also eventually became a general while associated with the CIA. And you mentioned, Monty, that Dean Rusk had worked for Admiral Hillenkoetter, spelled capital HILLENKOETER, at the CIA. And yeah. can you encapsulate Rusk's work for Hillenkoetter at CIA?
Yeah, absolutely. When Admiral Hillenkoetter was the director of the Central Intelligence Agency, Captain David Dean Rusk was his executive secretary. So, yeah, the personal assistant to the DCI, that was Dean Rusk's job for Admiral Hillenkoetter.
So he was not a colonel then, he was only a captain.
He was a captain at the time, yeah.
Oh, okay, very good. And
I believe Bonesteel was also a captain in 1946, so.
Okay, so he was a captain, and he eventually became a general and worked for General Westmoreland.
That's right.
For the CIA. Now, we mentioned
he was essentially, real quick, Bonesteel was essentially General Westmoreland's CIA focal point officer. So, you know, you know, Bonesteel was his liaison officer to the CIA.
We'll get to that eventually as well. Now, we mentioned that Syngman Rhee became the fascist dictator of South Korea, but the guy in charge of the border forces between North and South Korea, and this is very important, we're going to get into some information from I.F. Stone's The Hidden History of the Korean War. The North Koreans and other independent researchers have backed up the North Korean allegation that the South actually attacked first and the North Korean, quote, invasion, unquote, was a counterattack. But the guy who, and we'll get into that discussion, but the guy who was in charge of the border forces for Syngman-rhee and South Korea was a guy named General Kim Suk-won, notably a Korean national. He became the highest ranking, put a question mark by that, but did he become the highest ranking Japanese general when the Japanese occupied Korea, Monty?
That's right. He was an ethnic Korean, and the Nazis had a term during the Second World War called honorary Aryan that was ascribed to the senior leadership of the party or the Waffen-SS that were in fact members of emigre units. And I know there was a similar term in Japanese, but that's essentially what General Kim Suk-won was. He was an honorary Japanese, yeah.
And he was very, very important, and he had gotten, he's done work that's called, quote, quote, bandit hunter, unquote, which means counterinsurgency.
That's right, yeah. Yeah, Kim Suk-won was in charge of Japanese intelligence operations for, once again, to borrow a Nazi term, bandit hunting or bandit fighting operations, which, to put that into the proper perspective, you know, he ran all border operations, for the Japanese that were involved specifically for hunting, who would eventually become the future, premier of the Chinese government, you know.
You mean the North Korean government?
The North Korean government, excuse me, yes, the North Korean government, which, of course, was
Kim Il-sung?
Kim Il-sung, thank you. Thank you so much. These names are getting a little garbled. But yes, he ran a border hunter-killer unit that was trying to assassinate the future premier of North Korea. And that area of responsibility cannot be downplayed. And once again, to put it in the proper historical perspective, I would compare Kim Suk-won's operational scope to the operations of General Bak Zalewski and the Eastern Front during the Second World War.
We spoke about Bak Zalewski in the past, but for purposes of the present discussion, Kim Suk-won was in charge of the border forces for Syngman-rhee in South Korea. And I have Stone in The Hidden History of the Korean War notes that, first of all, Syngman-rhee was not popular, and there was a very good possibility that the South Korean parliament would vote to reunite with the North and the outbreak of the Korean War of Deep Six. That possibility, it also solidified Chiang Kai-shek's position on what is now Taiwan and any possibility that communist Chinese might have been able to oust him was eliminated by the outbreak of war in Korea, because that would have brought the U.S. and the Seventh Fleet into play, and that would have precluded that. And it also basically gave impetus to the revival of both Japanese and German industry to help manufacture munitions for the Korean War. And we, in the past, we've spoken about Nikolai Maloxa and Western Tube, and how that basically, the rationale of using that for the Korean War effort helped to keep that Iron Guard war criminal in the U.S. courtesy of Richard Nixon. And one of the things we also are going to talk about, and by the way, a huge shout out to all the people involved with the movie JFK and the subsequent JFK Revisited, the brilliant Jim DiGenio, Oliver Stone, and many others as well. But one of the things that was not included in that film was JFK's crackdown on Syngman-rhee and his white terror, which undoubtedly further alienated the military, the CIA, and the right wing in this country from JFK, and probably was yet another, I would say, was another contributing factor to the coup d'etat on 11/22/63.
Well, not to mention, real quick, that you know, the home base of the Unification Church is, of course, South Korea, and there's overwhelming evidence, which we will present in a future program, I'm sure, that the Unification Church was, in fact, the front for Japanese intelligence and later the CIA, you know, the fledgling Central Intelligence Agency. So we'll present that in a later program.
Absolutely. And the brilliant research of Professor Jeffrey Bale about the Unification Church being in every an element of which was at every U.S. embassy around the world, I think by the early 1960s. But the
By 1962, every single U.S. embassy on a global scale, on the planet, had a Unification Church representative that was reporting directly to the chief of South Korean CIA. So,
and for the record, program 970, among other programs, we have Daniel Junis and his discussion of the Unification Church, which I opined decades ago that was an extension of the Japanese patriotic and ultranationalist societies around the world.
Absolutely.
And through the, the ages, and he concurred with that. And by the way, on the Patreon channel, Patreon platform, we've now got the three talks I did a week ago yesterday. And a fellow who passed away recently was Tongsin Park, the focal point of the Koreagate scandal, the, quote, special prosecutor, unquote, for which was none other than Leon Jaworski, a special prosecutor if ever there was one. But the... The Koreagate scandal, although it did not get mentioned predictably in the New York Times obituary, it did mention that Tongsin Park was working for South Korean intelligence, but it went to the Unification Church. There is good documentation on that in the book Gifts of Deceit by, Robert Beecher, so last name Beepcher, who was
As an editorial note right there, Dave, I just want to inject. There was actually mention of the Koreagate scandal in the New York Times, but it was actually downplaying the entire scandal. And the man that wrote that article for the New York Times was a former CIA station chief in Cairo, a man by the name of Miles Copeland.
Oh, well, that must have been at the time, because Copeland passed away. I'm talking about the obituary that appeared for Tongsin Park.
Oh, for sure. I just wanted to inject that real quick. Yeah, at the time of the Koreagate scandal, yes, Miles Copeland was working for the New York Times, and he did write several articles downplaying the scandal. But please continue. I'm sorry for interrupting.
Well, yeah, Robert Beecher wrote a good book called Gifts of the Sea. He was a former aide
right.
to Democratic Congressman Donald Fraser, and he documented the Unification Church role in the Koreagate scandal, and we spoke about that in AFA program number 7. We also spoke about the alleged suicide of the aforementioned Robert Beecher, who supposedly jumped off a roof in New York City and killed himself. I'll leave it to people to decide if that was really the case. Another of the topics we will be covering, we will be taking a look at someone we've already spoken about at great length, General Charles Willoughby. Jim Wilcott, who is a name that will be familiar to JFK assassination researchers, but it turns out that when he wrote a pay voucher for Lee Harvey Oswald, Wilcott was actually operating at the behest of and in conjunction with Japanese fascists. We'll also be talking about E. Howard Hunt and his role overseeing CIA covert operations in Japan. And we'll talk about JFK's attempts to extricate us from Vietnam and something that I'm completing an article about for the aforementioned Patreon channel. Isuke Ono, the father of Yoko Ono, formerly married to John Lennon, he was a Japanese naval intelligence paymaster in the U.S. in 1933, and the guy he was paying, Frederick Rutland, worked for Mitsubishi, and he was not only training Japanese pilots to fly off of ships in the early 20s, but also requisitioning aircraft for the Imperial Japanese Naval Air Arm, which was financed in considerable measure by contraband, meaning dope, you name it, by Kadami Yoshio. And we will also talk about the position of Yoko Ono in post Well, I mean, Aisuki Ono, not Yoko Ono, the position of Aisuki Ono in the post-World War II banking milieu, which is inextricably linked with the Golden Lily and also to people involved with the Bank of International Settlements, the Schroeder Bank, Mr. Tarkas, Norbert Bogdan, and the Bank of Tokyo, with whom Aisuki Ono was an official, and it was a successor to the Yokohama Specie Bank, 25% of which was owned by the Japanese emperor, and it was a major vehicle for trafficking the Golden Lily route abroad. Now, in the description for both 1345 and 1346, our initial discussions of the pivot to Asia, there are links both to For the Record 905 and For the Record 1141, not only documenting the profound capital connections between U.S. high rollers, between Wall Street and their counterparts in Japan, as Sterling Seagrave and Peggy Seagrave noted in the Yamato Dynasty, the American oligarchs rescued their Japanese counterparts, unquote, at the end of World War II. But there's also discussion at great length in 1141 of the brutal Japanese subjugation of Korea, which took place over centuries. I'm just going to read a couple of quick excerpts from that, from the aforementioned Gold Warriors by the Seagraves. And the murder of Queen Min of Korea could be seen as something of a microcosm for how the Japanese behaved in Korea. They write about her murder. The defenseless queen was stabbed and slashed repeatedly and carried wailing out to the palace garden, where she was thrown onto a pile of firewood, drenched with kerosene, and set aflame. An American military advisor, General William Dye, was one of several foreigners who heard and saw the Japanese killers milling around in the palace compound with drawn swords, and the queen, while the queen was burned alive. And an observer, an analyst, Korean historian Y. K. Beck, capital Y-I, last name capital K-I-B-E-C-K, speaking of the brutality of the Japanese occupation of Korea, General Perauchi, that's Perauchi, was extraordinarily brutal, setting a precedent for Japanese behavior in all the countries it would occupy over the coming decades. Determined to crush all resistance, he told Koreans, quote, "I will whip you with scorpions," unquote. He set up a sadistic police force of Korean yakuza, ordering it to use torture as a matter of course for, quote, "No Oriental can be expected to tell the truth except under torture," unquote. These police were closely supervised by Japan's Gestapo, the Kempei Tai. "Japan's aim," said Korean historian Y. K. Beck, quote, "was to eradicate consciousness of Korean national identity, roots and all, and thus to obliterate the very existence of the Korean people from the face of the earth. The peninsula was stripped of everything from artworks to root vegetables. As Korea now belonged to Japan, the transfer of cultural property looming was not theft. How can you steal something that already belongs to you?" And the longer history is in For the Record 1141, and there is a link to that in the description for 1345 and 1346, as there will be for the descriptions here as well. By the way, Park Won-soon, who was the very popular mayor of Seoul, South Korea, he filed a suit against the Shincheonji cult with doctrinal and operational overlap with the Unification Church we just spoke about, and it appears to have been the vehicle for the spreading of COVID in South Korea. That was the focal point of Park Won-soon's suit. And also, the Shincheonji cult had a branch in Wuhan. And Park Won-soon was very critical of the Japanese occupation of Korea. He had done much for Japanese, for Korean women, who were subjugated as comfort women. And he was viewed as, he was also, well, aiming toward reunification eventually, or certainly friendlier relations with North Korea. And he was basically a very, very good chance he was going to become a popular presidential candidate, but then he allegedly committed suicide. So I'm skeptical about that. So I want to ask your indulgence, Mommy. Forgive me, I've been going on at great length here, but that this is going to be a long series. And I'm hoping that this overview gives people an inkling of the continuity. Again, what the pivot to Asia, as Obama put it, and which was then amped up or ramped up by Donald Trump, and amped up or ramped up even more by Joe Biden, and will be amped up or ramped up even more if Trump gets in. By the way, Trump's political mentor and his attorney for some time was the late Roy Cohn, who, along with Joe McCarthy, was a major pursuer of the a major operator on behalf of the China lobby as well. So perhaps the roots of the acorns.
In fact, if I may, around the time that Trump and Roy Cohn became bosom buddies, it should be appreciated that Roy Marcus Cohn was one of the founding members of the Western Goals Foundation, which was directly implicated in the Korea Gate and the Iran-Contra affair. So,
and also the death of Congressman Larry McDonald and the quote shoot down of KL007. So, Marty, we've got about 14 minutes in the show, and then we'll continue with this discussion in our next program. So, where would you like to? We left off with Operation Sunrise and the transition from combat to basically what we were told was the Cold War eventually became the hot war in Korea and in Vietnam, as probably noted. And some of the documentation for the bullet points, and I guess that term gets takes on an added gravitas under the circumstances. I noted again on my Patreon channel, I think it was last year, Monty, there was a New York Times article that referred to Korea as a Japanese protectorate during World War II. I mean, ye gods, that's like describing Auschwitz as a housing project for Jewish refugees. I mean, it's just, it's surreal. Absolutely surreal. The nature of that, quote, protectorate was in that passage that I just read. So, again, to give people an overview, and Marty, your observation is absolutely correct. My programs over the decades have been Eurocentric, but the same thing was going on in Asia as was going on in Europe, and we basically picked up the Japanese agenda in World War II, and that
is correct, Dave. And it should be noted that though your research is Eurocentric, what you have done with Operation Sunrise is brilliant, astounding, in my opinion, considering the pushback of shall I say mainstream historians. But it has to be appreciated that this dramatic pivot to Asian intelligence operations was in fact initiated by two men. And that would be Guido Zimmer, as we pointed out in the previous program that we did, and Alan Dulles, you know, who would later become director of the Central Intelligence Agency and longest-serving director at that.
And whose brother and fellow Sullivan and Cromwell attorney John Foster Dulles was in Seoul, South Korea with Kodama Yoshio and Machiz Hayasuki, and he also set up the peace treaty in 1951 that Iris Chang was very critical of, and that basically enabled the Japanese to keep all of their wealth, and quite a bit of wealth that was, from World War II.
On that note, I'd like to pick up where we left off with Mr. Zimmer, and once again, quoting from archives.gov, this is from the Interagency Working Group for the Nazi War Crimes Interagency Working Group.
By the way, the man's name was Guido, G-U-I-D-O Zimmer, Z-I-M-M-E-R. Continue, Monty.
Correct. And this is from the records of the Central Intelligence Agency, from their own 201 file from Guido Zimmer. And yes, Mr. Zimmer had a 201 file, and I know you referenced that earlier in the program. Once again, just to encapsulate it, according to Jane Roman, the former CIA counterintelligence officer that was in charge of Mexico City operations for about a decade from 1953 to about 19, or actually longer than that, from 1953 to 1973, Jane Roman testified to the House Select Committee on Assassinations that a 201 file was an indicator that a person had a employee status, or at least a cutout status with the agency. So Zimmer was in fact a CIA officer. So now, quoting once again from the interagency working group documents from the National Archives, quote, Guido Zimmer was a mid-level SS officer involved in the Holocaust in Italy and in Nazi espionage. His notebooks, which are translated in the CIA's 201 file, offer insight into Nazi intelligence activities of the last year of the Second World War, particularly the Reich Security Main Office, Riesche, efforts to either negotiate a separate peace with the West or to divide the Allies against each other. In all likelihood, it was the latter. Zimmer's notebooks, originally in German shorthand, which covered his activities from May 1944 to March of 1945, contained new information about intelligence contacts that led to the surrender of German and Japanese forces in northern Italy, arranged by Alan Dulles on 2 May 1945. Dulles' negotiations, later codenamed Operation Sunrise, saved some lives and certainly added luster to his achievements as the head of the OSS office in Switzerland. However, the story of the secret German-American-Japanese negotiations in Switzerland between March and April 1945 was suppressed. And only elements of the European, meaning the German side of it, were serialized in magazine articles in the Saturday Evening Post in 1947, heavily edited by Alan Dulles himself. Although the purpose of the publicity was probably to counteract the tenacious and accurate Italian accounts of the surrender of German forces in Italy, some stories about Dulles' wartime successes helped him later become director of the CIA. Therefore, new evidence about the background of Operation Sunrise is historically quite significant, given Alan Dulles's destruction of central documents pertaining to it. Another significant element of Zimmer's files was that he was able to escape prosecution as a war criminal, partly through his exploiting his wartime intelligence contacts and dealing with Alan Dulles personally, who spoke up for him after the war. In that sense, his history mirrors the experience of some other Nazi officials that had relationships with Dulles. Now to give you a little bit of background about who Zimmer was. Born November 18, 1911 in Brewer, Westphalia. Guido Zimmer was a slim, athletic man of average height and dark brown hair and a high-pitched voice. He joined the Nazi Party in 1932, along with the SS and the SD in 1936. By 1940, as a member of the Foreign Intelligence Branch of the Reich's main security office, he was assigned to the Vatican in Rome, Italy. After Zimmer's cover was blown through a slip-up, he was recalled to Berlin. In September 1943, after Mussolini was overthrown and a new Italian government tried to sign an armistice, the Allied landing troops in southern Italy. Germany intervened with its own troops and SS and police, taking control of most of the country. Killings and deportations of Jews in Italy began. I should note that the head of SS forces in Italy was Karl Wolff. He was an SS Obergruppenführer who was the personal attaché between Heinrich Himmler, the head of the SS, and Adolf Hitler, the head of the Nazi Party. And as the commander of all SS forces in Italy, Karl Wolff oversaw the deportation of at least 2.5 million men, women, and children into the concentration camp systems.
And by the way, I would note something that I brought up in 1346. A character witness at his Nuremberg trial was none other than Lyman Lemnitzer, who was heavily involved with Sunrise as well. Lemnitzer was not only chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff under JFK and fought with him over various things. He appears to have been the architect of the I'm experiencing brain bubbles. The Operation North Woods agent provocateur operation, and later Lyman Lemnitzer was part of the Rockefeller Commission, which yet again whitewashed the JFK assassination. The final report was edited by, among others, Dick Cheney. So a wonderful degree of continuity there. So, yes, Guido Zimmer and Operation Sunrise. By the way, in terms of Ms. Roman's identification of the significance of a 201 file, the information about Masanobu and there being the liaison to Chiang Kai-shek comes from his 201 file. And,
we'll get to that soon in the follow-up program, but continue about Zimmer.
Yes. We've got about 5 minutes left. We'll just continue with this in the next show. Yep. Go ahead.
Perfect. Yeah. Okay. So Zimmer was assigned to Genoa, where he was, in charge of the tracking down imprisonment and then deportation of all of the Jews in northern Italy later on in Milan.
That would be Genoa. Yeah. Go ahead.
Genoa and Milan. His commander in Milan was the infamous SS Colonel Walter Roth, the head of security police in the SD group in northwestern Italy, also called Gruppo Oberitalien West. Years earlier, when he was a member of the, once again, the Reich's main security command's Criminal Technical Institute, Walter Roth was in charge of designing gassing vans to poison Jews and other victims on the Eastern Front. Roughly around 90,000 men, women, and children would be murdered in these mobile gas vans developed by Walter Roth, who was deputy to Guido Zimmer. Zimmer led a small team in Milan that seized Jewish property and lived well off the proceeds. He also obtained political information abroad and built up intelligence networks of agents that could supply Germany with intelligence if the Allies overran Italy. This was actually run through the Foreign Department of the Vatican, okay? And it has to be appreciated that the Vatican's main military intelligence liaison with the Japanese in this time period is General Seizu Arisu, who is the chief liaison between Japanese G2 and the Vatican, okay?
And later became, in your characterization, which I believe to be absolutely accurate, the Japanese Galen. Continue.
That's right. So by fall of 1944, espionage specialists were also thinking of ways to involve themselves in high-level diplomacy. Arisha, Foreign Intelligence Chief Walter Schellenberg, had been eager to initiate discussions with Western allies and hope that Germany can conclude an advantageous or respectable peace on one front. But there were two huge obstacles. The Allies demanded unconditional surrender from the Germans, and Hitler and his entourage were convinced that the alliance between the West and the Soviet Union was an unnatural bond that could never last. Under these circumstances, Schellenberg had to be extremely cautious in putting out feelers to the West. They had leeway to operate, but could always claim they were trying to cause trouble amongst the Allies by dividing them.
By the way, this would be a good stopping place. We'll pick right up there in our next interview. But I want to remind people of not only the discussion of Prince Max Egan von Hohenlohe and his negotiations with Dulles as an agent of Schellenberg, but also the new 64-gigabyte flash drive containing all of my life's work, plus a small library of old anti-fascist books on easy-to-download PDF files. And this will contain all of the interviews with Monty and also all of my work on COVID. That 64-gigabyte flash drive will be available later this year. So people who have been, and I encourage everyone to archive this material, I want to mention that you can basically secure that. Now I get no money whatsoever from this. Monty gets no money whatsoever from this. Again, proof positive, perhaps, that I'm crazy as a moon. We've got about a minute and a half left here, Monty. So maybe...
Well, on that note, we'll pick up with Walter Schellenberg and his operations with an OSS officer by the name of Paul Bloom, and Paul Bloom's operations with a Japanese intelligence agent by the name of Yushiro Fujimura, last name spelled F-U-G-I-M-U-R-A, and Lieutenant Commander Fujimura's operations with Yoshio Kadama, and the secret surrender between Alan Dulles and Japanese intelligence, along with Guido Zimmer and Carl Wolf. So we'll pick up with that in the next program.
Yes, indeed. And this concludes For the Record program number 1349, Conversations with Monty. This is conversation number 23. This is being recorded on October 5th of the year 2024. For Monty, this is Dave Emery saying thanks for listening.